Welcome back, everyone, to the political scene, where every week I trudge through the muck of the New Yorker's political podcast called The Political Scene. My name is Russ Finkelstein. Generally, the New Yorker's political scene podcast is hosted by New Yorker writers Jane Mayer, Susan Glasser, and Evan Osnos, all incredible in their own right. But this week, there's some bad news for all you Evan heads out there. Evan Osnos was apparently delayed while traveling and could not make it to the microphone this week. So Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer instead had on a guest in his place. I'll let Susan Glasser introduce her.
I'm especially interested, I have to say right now, in what Republican voters are thinking and those independents who may no longer identify as Republicans, but maybe they really are. So we thought, who better to join us than somebody who actually grew up in that world, who understands them. I'm going to say she's my own favorite Republican whisperer, if we can call her that. Sarah Longwell is joining us today. She's a longtime conservative strategist for the last 8 years. Wow, 8 years. Has convened a variety of focus groups with former and even current Trump supporters to try to understand what motivates them.
So in addition to convening focus groups and trying to dislodge the Republican Party from Donald Trump's clutches, what Susan Glasser doesn't tell you there is that Sarah Longwell has also been a right-wing lobbyist and political activist for more than 15 years. She worked previously with a law firm and lobbying group called Berman & Company, who, for example, fought against environmental regulation by trying to personally attack and embarrass people who support environmentalist causes. This is from a New York Times article in 2014 by Eric Lipton about Richard Berman, who's the founder of Berman & Company, where Sarah Longwell worked. If the oil and gas industry wants to prevent its opponents from slowing its efforts to drill in more places, it must be prepared to employ tactics like digging up embarrassing tidbits about environmentalists and liberal celebrities, a veteran Washington political consultant told a room full of industry executives in a speech that was secretly recorded. So that veteran Washington political consultant was Richard Berman, Sarah Longwell's longtime boss. What Mr. Berman did not know, and what could now complicate his task of marginalizing environmental groups that want to impose limits on fracking, is that one of the energy industry executives recorded his remarks and was offended by them. Quote, "that you have to play dirty to win," unquote, said the executive, who provided a copy of the recording and the meeting agenda to the New York Times under the condition that his identity not be revealed. Quote, "it just left a bad taste in my mouth." So basically, Richard Berman gave a speech to a bunch of oil and gas executives about how to fight against environmental activists that was so aggressive and in such poor taste that it offended one of those energy company executives, who then leaked a recording of that speech to the New York Times. The article goes on, quote, "I get up every morning and I try to figure out how to screw with the labor unions. That's my offense," Mr. Berman said in his speech to Western Energy Alliance. Mr. Berman repeatedly boasted about how he could take checks from oil and gas industry executives and then hide their role in funding his campaigns. Quote, "people always ask me one question all the time. How do I know that I won't be found out as a supporter of what you're doing?" Mr. Berman told the crowd. Quote, "we run all of this stuff through nonprofit organizations that are insulated from having to disclose donors. There is total anonymity. People don't know who support us." So that's who Sarah Longwell spent 15 years working for before she made a name for herself as an anti-Trump Republican strategist. She's not just an independent observer who has some thoughts on how to defeat Donald Trump. She's a conservative who's employed some pretty nasty tactics in order to further the cause of corporations, usually at the expense of the American people. So my hypothesis is she's not just giving clean, objective advice to Democrats about how to beat Donald Trump. She's also trying to make sure that the Democratic Party and the Biden administration is including the interests of the people and corporations she's always worked for in its governing coalition. That's why she's going to try to frame the 2024 race as one in which Joe Biden needs to make sure he's reaching out to moderate Republicans over, say, progressives or leftists or young people or people of color who make up Biden's base who might be turned off by him leaning to the right. But suffice to say, she's pushing a political ideology here. She's not just giving strategic analysis.
So you're fighting for this group in the middle. They are still center right. They don't like Trump and they don't like Biden. There are double haters. And because you've got two functional incumbents, you're going to have the worst scenario for voters, which is there's not really someone to vote for. There's just someone to vote against. And voters in the focus groups always use the phrase. I mean, just constantly. If it was a drinking game, I'd be dead. They just, when you say, like, how are you going to make your choice? And they use the phrase, the lesser of two evils. And that's depressing, right? Because, like, you don't think both these people are evil. I don't think they're equivalent. But that's how the voters view it. And so the reason the conviction matters, in my mind, is that when you are trying to convince whatever that percentage is, and no one knows exactly what it is, but I think, you know, it's like 10 to 12%. You are trying to convince them not to, you are not building a pro-Joe Biden coalition, you are building an anti-Trump coalition. And the biggest coalition in American politics is an anti-Trump coalition.
So this is something a lot of people like Sarah Longwell are pushing these days. Other Never Trump Republicans have similar pitches to Biden and the Biden campaign. Basically, run against Donald Trump, point to the fact that he's now a convicted felon, make Donald Trump the centerpiece of your campaign, and therefore you could attract what Longwell estimates are some 10% of people who are Republican voters reliably, but who might, after two previous elections of Trump, but who might at this point be so turned off by Trump that they're willing to vote for Biden. Of course, the more you play up Biden and his accomplishments as a liberal and as a Democrat, the more it could potentially turn off those voters. So she's basically saying, don't do that. Just basically bang the drum about how terrible Trump is. Of course, the mirror image of this strategy is look at how old and feeble Joe Biden is.
I get yelled at all the time. People are like, the only people think Biden's old is because you guys in the media never stop talking about it. And I'm like, I am just sorry, guys. But whether it is Democrats or swing voters, or Republicans say he has dementia. But like Democrats sit there and constantly say, I get so nervous. I get so nervous when he talks. I just want him to do okay, but I'm so worried about him. I just worried he's going to fall.
Yeah, we're familiar with that dynamic, right, Jane?
I mean, I was just visiting with my mom, who's 98, and she just said to me, oh, you know, it's just such an ironic, he finally won when he was too old. And so the old people recognize it too, you know?
So I think there is a lot for Democrats to be worried about regarding Biden's age. It's something we can all see with our own eyes. That he's aging and that he's the oldest president we've ever had. And that if he's reelected, he'd be something like 86 years old by the time he finishes his second term. Like, given the way he's going these days, I don't know what would be left in 4.5 years from now. It would be a sight to behold, to say the least. I'm reading now from Susan Glasser's latest column in The New Yorker, which is about Joe Biden's speech in France to commemorate D-Day. It is true that Biden walked slowly during the proceedings and at times stumbled over his words. The White House would do well to stop pretending that, at age 81, the president has not lost a step or two. It is also true that he did not suddenly transform overnight into a spellbinding orator. But for what may well be his final D-Day encore before the great battle passes from living memory, Biden met the moment with a message that was bracing, urgent, and clarifying. In a speech at the Normandy American Cemetery that was anything but generic, he called out both Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine and, though he did not use his name, Donald Trump's isolationism, the dual threats that have animated this last political campaign of Biden's in a long life of them. Quote, "The autocrats of the world are watching closely," he said, and it was not a warning, really, so much as a statement of blunt fact about the stakes in this year's U.S. election and the foreign policy consequences that will flow from it. His opponent is an admirer of Putin, and reportedly of Hitler, even. Trump truly supports neither Ukraine nor NATO. All right, well, if that is the case, and if the contrast between these two is so stark, and Americans should be so alarmed by what re-electing Donald Trump would mean for America and for the world, how is it that the Democratic Party is allowing a guy who's 81 years old to be the party nominee? We're going to get to this in a minute, like the lack of urgency on the part of Democrats. But yeah, I think it's interesting that the pundits of the New Yorker's political scene are constantly sort of drawing this contrast and outlining how high the stakes are in this election, and yet also basically trying to put lipstick on the pig of a presidential nominee, the only hope to make sure Donald Trump doesn't turn America into the Fourth Reich, being an 81-year-old man who's basically decomposing in front of our very eyes. Jumping down in Glasser's column here, quote, "It says something about the politics of 2024, indeed, that rather than seeing foreign policy as Trump's vulnerability, some now view it as a problem for Biden, who struggled for months to get the Republican House of Representatives to provide billions of dollars in aid to Ukraine, a delay that caused battlefield setbacks and a drop in morale, even as his own Democratic Party grew painfully divided over the president's strong public support for Israel in its war against Hamas." Again, in all of the strategies discussed by Longwell over the course of the podcast, never once do they mention policy things that Biden could do. He's currently the president. He could do something regarding Israel and the painful divide that Biden's strong support for Israel in its war against Hamas has caused, according to Glasser's own article. So it's like, yeah, they just want to figure out how to message effectively, but I guess it's the limitations of talking to a Republican strategist in this conversation is, like, somehow they're talking about politics without actually talking about politics, or they're talking about campaign messaging without acknowledging the fact that Joe Biden's still the president, and there's a lot of things he could do that would be tremendously popular and probably motivate a lot more people to vote for him. One last paragraph here from Susan Glasser's column. Reading back through the interview the other day, she's talking about the interview that Donald Trump gave to Time magazine. "I was struck that Trump had said, almost word for word, the language about Russia and China and, quote, the enemy within, that he repeated once again this week. I think the enemy from within, in many cases, is much more dangerous for our country than the outside enemies of China, Russia, and various others that would be called enemies depending on who the president is, frankly." This, then, was not an idle observation of Trump's, but a theme of his campaign, the theme of his campaign. So she seems to be sort of alarmed by the fact that Donald Trump is saying that the biggest enemy America faces is the enemy within, which does sort of mirror like the ideological framework of fascism. Of course, Glasser in this column is making a sort of parallel argument about Donald Trump, and that Trump and the Trumpist movement and his political campaign, and God forbid his re-election, is also incredibly dangerous and by the same logic, a danger within. So again, here there seems to be a bit of a lack of self-awareness in understanding that Donald Trump is saying that the biggest challenge America faces is the enemy within. Susan Glasser seems to believe the same thing.
Real talk to my friends on the Democratic side. There's a lot of discussion about democracy being at stake, but I would say the urgency of the campaign and of Democrats in general doesn't feel like democracy is at stake.
Hey, when you're right, you're right. I totally agree with her.
The thing that I think would most change the trajectory of this race is that if Democrats deployed like every governor, all of the surrogates, I mean, the Democrats have this incredible bench between Abigail Spanberger and Alyssa Slotkin and Mikey Sherrill and Gretchen Whitmer and Jared Polis and Josh Shapiro. And right now, if you think about who's the best surrogate, who's out there all the time getting in front of Republicans, getting in their faces, doing, it's Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom is like the only one.
Okay, that's just not true. I guess Newsom did debate DeSantis on Fox News, but I don't know. I mean, when you think about who's going toe-to-toe with Republicans, she's naming a bunch of these blue dog, sort of more right-leaning Democratic members of Congress or governors. Super pro-Israel, pro-military industrial complex. They were the members of Congress who were scolding the left in 2020 for the slogan "defund the police," if anyone remembers that era. She doesn't mention Jamal Bowman. She doesn't mention Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She doesn't mention Cori Bush. She doesn't mention Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar. I would say those are the people that probably take on Republicans more than anyone else. But of course, she's not going to mention these people because she disagrees with them and thinks that they should be marginalized from the Democratic Party. I don't know who raises more money and gets more attention, especially from young people, than AOC. Clearly, her politics come into direct conflict with Longwell's funders or constituents or the people that she's representing here. So, of course, she's never going to make that suggestion.
One of the things Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan have a lot of are these older white voters who, it's funny because Democrats are like, but that doesn't feel like a natural part of our coalition. But that's sort of your movable voter right now. Those are the ones who actually say, no, attacking the Capitol, like a slice of them saying attacking the Capitol is not okay. Siding with Putin is not okay. They're the ones who are old school Republicans. Those are the Nikki Haley voters. If you're a young Republican now, if you're a Republican who's 25, 26, you came to the party because of Trump. You don't understand why someone like Nikki Haley would be appealing. But older voters who came to the party for different reasons, they're the ones who see Trump as anathema to what the Republican Party stood for, which is why I think that sort of blue wall that crumbled for Hillary Clinton is what Joe Biden really needs to hold his coalition together.
Okay, so if you accept the premise that the only gettable voters and the people that need to be persuaded in this election and the people that the Biden campaign should be reaching out to are old white voters in swing states who might have voted for Donald Trump but are willing to break with him because of January 6th. Let's just look at the numbers from 2016 and 2020. So, for example, in Michigan, in 2016, Donald Trump won Michigan 47.50% to Hillary Clinton's 47.27%. That is less than a quarter of a percent difference, 2.279 million votes for Donald Trump, 2.268 million votes for Hillary Clinton. So that's about 11,000 votes in Michigan in 2016 that made the difference. Voter turnout in 2016 was 63% in the state of Michigan. In 2020, voter turnout in Michigan was 71%. Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by a bigger margin than Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by in 2016. 50.62% voted for Joe Biden, 47.84% voted for Donald Trump, 2.804 million votes for Biden, 2.649 for Donald Trump. So that's, I don't know, 150,000 votes basically that made the difference in 2020. My point being that voter turnout ended up making a big difference between 2016 and 2020. I would be willing to say a bigger difference than the amount of swing voters who might have changed their minds about which candidate they're voting for. So my theory for the case is the more energized your base is, the more people will turn out to vote for you on election day, and that turnout is going to probably end up having a much bigger impact on the election than your ability to get a very small number of voters to switch from one candidate to the other.
When it comes to what can be done, again, I'm going to take an all of the above attitude along with talking about sort of vibes and posture, right? I mean, a bunch of things need to happen. One, Joe Biden's got to clear people's bar of dementia, right? He's got to perform. He's got to be out there. He's got to do well at the debates. The debates are going to matter a great deal. And everybody's going to have to get to that acceptance point where, like, Biden's not switching out Kamala Harris. Biden's not, you know, stepping down.
This is such a tall order. I honestly don't think it's possible. Like, seriously, how are voters going to watch Joe Biden in a debate or even just Joe Biden do anything and say this man absolutely is going to make it through the next 4.5 years as president and will not have to be replaced by Kamala Harris? I have eyes just like everyone else does. I don't know how anyone would draw that conclusion.
She's got a very strategic mind. What did you make of her prescription for Biden and how to, you know, get out there and start campaigning?
I mean, I thought it was very compelling. I mean, and I do actually think sometimes it takes someone outside the party establishment, outside of the Democrats, to take a look at freshly and say, you know, what you need to do. You're not doing it. I have to agree with her that she's right, that there really is an exciting bench in the next generation of leaders in the Democratic Party all across the country, who I would think would be dying to get out there just to raise their profiles and their name recognition.
It's just so funny to me how unabashedly lib Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer are. Like, they have zero self-awareness that they find it so refreshing and so exciting to hear commentary from a Republican about what Democrats should do with their election campaign. And Jane Mayer says there, sometimes you need someone with an outside perspective. They would never have a socialist come on their podcast and say what they think Democrats should do and take those suggestions seriously. At least once in the conversation, they should have asked her if she doesn't think that the Biden campaign trying to court moderate Republicans might alienate part of its own base and suppress voter turnout, and that leaning into more progressive policy accomplishments or strategies or campaign promises might energize the base in a way that would make a bigger difference than trying to pursue this tiny sliver of moderate Republicans. But they never asked her that question during the entire episode.
If you look at it, right, Democrats have increasingly become the party of the college educated. In fact, that's the single biggest dividing line. When you look at many surveys, the level of education is the highest correlation predictor of whether you're going to be a Democrat or Republican these days. And so it's a realignment reflected in the fascinating kind of Trumpification of people like Marco Rubio. And it's also the difference in messaging. Donald Trump is promising tax cuts to the wealthy, but of course, that's not the rhetoric that he's taking to the campaign trail. When he talks to voters, he's selling something that's clearly appealing.
I agree with Susan Glasser, God help me. Donald Trump is selling something appealing to voters, especially working class voters, with the economic protectionism, and he hints or gestures at being pro-union, although he clearly is anti-union and undermined unions when he went to campaign at a non-union car shop in Michigan. The United Auto Workers had just endorsed Joe Biden, and I think Trump thought he could go make some sort of unionist play there. But his policies are the exact opposite of union friendly. So I do think that is an opportunity for the Biden campaign. Like, one thing they could lean into is Joe Biden's accomplishments with unions, legislation he's passed, his Department of Labor that's been more favorable to intervening in these labor disputes and weighing in, for example, having Amazon redo union elections where they failed to unionize, the Department of Labor found, because of illegal activity on the part of management. So there's a lot that Joe Biden could brag about on the campaign trail, accomplishments he's had for working class people. And I do think that would be an effective thing for their campaign to do to counter this working class, blue collar message that Donald Trump has disingenuously conveyed.
What I love about Sarah is that she's trying to operate in the world as it is and not as we would hope that it would be. And I, for me, a final bottom line takeaway, mine is Donald Trump is the single most effective campaigner for Joe Biden. The more that he's in the center of the picture, the better the prospects of Biden getting reelected.
I still think, like, you're talking about political strategy here and what Democrats could do to make sure they win this election. And as Susan Glasser outlined in her column, avert the danger of Donald Trump being reelected for the United States and for the world. Why not have someone else be the Democratic nominee in 2024? It's not too late. They could still do it. They haven't had their convention. The longer that the war in Israel goes on, the more in danger the Biden campaign is of having a super low voter turnout and basically handing the election to Donald Trump. Joe Biden, months ago, could have stepped aside, allowed for a competitive primary to play out, and perhaps a better candidate would have emerged. But instead, The Democratic Party is sinking basically what they say is the future of democracy in this country into the campaign of an 81-year-old man. But I do think it'll be fun to watch. I'm very excited to see these two debate each other. I think it's going to be hilarious and maybe kind of scary, but really, really funny. That is the political race that we deserve because we're garbage people.